Dr. Kenneth Hansen. We never had him on the broadcast before. We're very pleased to have him now. He's kind of a real-life Indiana Jones type. He's a dynamic author. He's written several books, a lecturer. He's founder of Treasures in Time. TreasuresInTime.org is his website, TreasuresInTime.org. Also a YouTube channel. You can look up Kenneth Hansen and see many of his videos. He's done digs, archaeological digs, in many of the most politically charged regions in the world and some of the most interesting biblical type archaeology you can imagine. We are excited to have him on. Kenneth Hansen, Dr. Hansen, welcome to the Power Hour.
Good to be with you, and a warm shalom from the University of Central Florida in Orlando.
It's right by you and Mickey Mouse, I guess, huh?
Yeah. We associate with him a lot, especially our students.
Very good. Excited to have you on to talk about kind of this, really, this Indiana Jones type stuff. Let's talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls. You're somewhat of an expert on that. You've written about it extensively. Tell us about the history of it, what we need to know about the Dead Sea Scrolls.
I like to tell people you could not make this up. And yeah, it's better than Indiana Jones. It all started back in the late spring or early summer of 1947, just a couple years after the end of World War II. It's the lowest spot on the face of the earth. We're talking about the Dead Sea. This is more than 1,200 feet below the level of the Mediterranean. Forget Death Valley. This is utterly parched, barren, desolate territory. Just a few desert shrubs and bushes and a few flocks of goats who feed on them. And, of course, we got the Bedouin rummaging around out there, as they've done for thousands of years. Bedouin shepherds in their Bedouin tents. And they're basically sheep and goat herders. And one afternoon, there's a young Bedouin goat herder by the name of Muhammad Adib is his name. And he's out there tending his flock of goats and realizes one of his goats has gone missing from the rest. So he leaves his flock and he goes searching through a series of caves, lonely desert caves that just pockmark the cliffs that rise up from the western shore of the Dead Sea, imagining maybe his goat has gone astray into one of them. Doesn't find any animal, but after a while, in desperation, he starts throwing stones into the cave entrances, one after another, hoping he'll frighten out any wayward beast into the open. And when he lets loose one stone in particular, his ears are pricked by a most curious sound. It's like something deep inside that cave is breaking, cracking. Sounds like breaking pottery. And he hauls his torso halfway up the side of that cliff and squeezes through the very narrow cave entrance, and he's confronted by a whole series of big earthenware jars leaning up against the inner wall of that cave, and his stone has struck one of them. He manages to muster his courage and starts rifling through the jars, prying the lids off one after another. They are empty, except one. There's a big bundle of something inside one of those jars, covered over by a sort of flaxen material that's falling apart. He has no idea what he's found, hauls it out of that jar, forgets about his goat, goes back to his Bedouin campsite. And you can just get this picture in your mind. There that night by the fire of the Bedouin, they pull away this flaxen cover, and they're greeted by several pieces of sadly decaying parchment material covered over by a chicken scratch sort of writing that they can't read at all. The Bedouin's native tongue is, of course, Arabic. And this is written in ancient Hebrew. And they have no idea what they have found. But they take their discoveries and start hawking them around to various locations. They take them in particular to the Shuk, which is the open marketplace in a little town called Bethlehem. And they find a little shop, general store, owned and operated by a part-time cobbler, part-time antiquities dealer. His name is Kondo. And they sell him a few of these scrolls. This dealer, he doesn't know what he's bought either. He also reads only Arabic. But that is the beginning of the saga of the Dead Sea Scrolls. They turn out to be the most important archaeological find of the 20th century, maybe ever. And that's only the beginning. because after that they pass from hand to hand, and then an archbishop in Jerusalem buys some of them, and then a professor from the Hebrew University, who is Israeli, born in this land, receives a little scrap of this parchment through a chain-link fence that divides East and West Jerusalem, because the city is divided in those days. It's like a no-man's land. Again, you could not make this up. You got a professor receiving through the chain-link in no-man's land.
Oh, my word.
Little fragment of parchment.
Hold that. Boy, history is an amazing thing, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? If you were to have a Hollywood script basically describing what you just heard, you think, boy, is that fiction. You think, boy, is that a bunch of nonsense. I mean,
it's too far out. Yeah, they would never make it. It couldn't
happen.
It's
too crazy. So let's continue this, because I've never heard it in quite this detail, this story. But so it got to somebody in Jerusalem who actually spoke Hebrew, or knew Hebrew, I guess. Let's go from there, and then what's the significance of why is this such an important find?
His name is Professor Elazar Sukhenik, and he's a professor at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. He receives through the chain link. He's there at no man's land between East and West Jerusalem. He receives a little sliver of parchment material, just a few lines on it. He looks at it, and for the first time, somebody can read this. And he's blown away. He wants to know from the guy on the other side, who's an Arab dealer, where did you get this? Where did you get this? And the guy says, well, there's this guy from Bethlehem, a shopkeeper, cobbler, a part-time antiquities dealer. He's up and got a shop in Bethlehem. And Professor Sukhenik decides right then and there, I'm going to Bethlehem. Now, remember when this took place, 1947? This is before there was a state of Israel, but it's on the eve of Israel's war of independence. There's a major war about to break out. And you got a Jewish professor who makes an incognito journey from Jerusalem to basically enemy territory, to Arab territory in Bethlehem, to find this dealer. And he finds the guy. And they sit down together, and they start to negotiate. And in the end, the professor walks away with almost complete scrolls that he takes back to Jerusalem, hightails it back to Jerusalem. One of them is a partial scroll of the book of the prophet Isaiah, 2,000 years old. Now, up until this time, the oldest copies of the biblical text, the Hebrew Bible, known to exist in the world, were medieval. They dated from around 1,000 of the Common Era, 1,000 A.D. or C.E. as we call it. Now he's got a scroll in his hand in ancient Hebrew, handwritten, that predates the previous oldest copy of a biblical text, talking the prophet Isaiah, not by a century or two or three or four, but 1,000 years older than the previous oldest text known to exist in the world. And comparing them, you know, we didn't even know how much the Bible had changed over the centuries. A lot of talk, maybe the whole thing was fabricated out of whole cloth, as it were. And just willy-nilly, they changed this, altered that. This was almost word-for-word identical to the copies of the text that came down to
us. Wow.
And that's just...
How surprised were they, was he, that, one, it was even similar, or, you know, that was so similar, and then, two, what did that do? Were people doubting the Bible at all? I mean, what did that do to the archaeological, to biblical, historical community at that point?
It was so earth-shattering that a lot of serious scholars couldn't even accept that it was genuine. And there is a lively forgery industry that goes on in the Middle East. Talk about Indiana Jones. You got to know what artifacts are real and what are bogus and phony. There's a lot of fake ones. And they were saying this has to be a forgery. It has to be a fake. Nothing that old survived. And how, in the end, did the professor prove that it was old as he was sure it was? Just by the handwriting analysis. That's a science in itself. I can look at a piece of Hebrew text, and just by the way the letters are written, I can know basically how old that text is. And everything is telling the professor this is 2,000 years old. So how does he prove it? Well, carbon dating back then was just in its infancy. But decided to use it. And sure enough, they got a date that placed it right in the ancient world. And that nailed it. People had to come to grips with the reality of this thing. But then secondly, the professor had purchased a scroll of Psalms. Now, we think of the biblical book of Psalms, but this wasn't. They look a lot like biblical Hebrew Psalms. They sound a lot like them, but not one of them ever made it into our Bibles. An entire book of Psalms unknown to the world until 1947. And a lot of them deal with mystical, messianic themes. Whoever wrote this text, this sect who lived out there in the desert, were fixated on the Messiah to come. And that brings now Christian studies and Jesus research into the whole mix. I'm a Judaica scholar, but now I'm dealing with Jesus, the historical Jesus. This is amazing. And then, thirdly, the professor bought a very strange text indeed, also unknown until 1947, 2,000 years old. It's basically called, we have a Hebrew name for it, Milchemet B'nei Or B'nei Choshech. I'm sure you got that. But it's called in English, The War Between the Sons of Light and Sons of Darkness. The war.
Mm.
And it details a series of seven great end time apocalyptic battles at the very end of the world. And it sounds hauntingly like a certain New Testament book you may have heard of. The book of...
The Revelation.
You got it. Except it's written in Hebrew, not Greek. And it predates the book of Revelation by at least 100 years.
Where can we read these unincluded Psalms and this book about? So where can we read this? Can we go to your website and find this? Or where can we read these things?
You can go to Amazon and you can pick up a book I wrote. Actually, my very first book was on this subject.
There you go.
The trouble with a lot of this stuff is, of course, we're dealing with the academic community, the scholarly community. I'm an academic myself. But we academics, we tend to write and speak to other academics. That's part of the problem. And the stuff is so exciting that I figured somebody needs to write in layman's language, you know, and just make these things available and tell the story of what happened. And then describe and explain in language that anybody can understand. So that was my first person when I wrote my book, Dead Sea Scrolls
at Amazon.
Yeah, Dead the Sea Untold Scrolls. Story is the subtitle. And then what I
awesome.
Started doing was creating a video because we teach at the university all kinds of Jewish studies. That's our program. But it also overlaps with a lot of Christian studies. And we started producing entire video series for our students, but they're unlike anything you ever saw. It's not just a talking head. We created a whole YouTube channel now, and you can go to that as well and find a lot of this information, a lot of this material.
Okay, a couple quick questions, quickly. What was the date again on the Dead Sea Scrolls that you're putting it at?
We're talking about a whole library of ancient texts that were composed in the first 2 centuries before the Common Era, or B.C. 2 centuries between the second and first centuries B.C.E., before the Common Era, before Jesus.
Now, another question, I kind of alluded to it, but let me ask more specific. It seems to me, you correct me if I'm wrong, in the archaeological world, it almost seems, I don't know if cover-up is the word, I don't know if that's the right word, but there seems like anything about Jesus or the Bible, it seems like that gets poo-pooed or that gets pushed aside almost instantaneously. Did these Dead Sea Scrolls, did that do anything to break through that wall?
Opened up a whole new field of study and research. Dead Sea Scroll studies. Actually, we call it Qumran studies because the location where these things were found were in and around an area called Qumran, which is an Arabic term, but it's right on the northwest corner of the Dead Sea. And it's just sent tidal waves across the whole, academic community as well. In fact, for decades, there was a whole hoard of Dead Sea Scroll material that was off limits, out of bounds to everybody except a select handful of scholars. That's how you call it, a cover-up. Well, not quite, but nobody could get their hands on thousands and thousands of fragments that came out
Why?
Of those caves. There was
Why?
A lot
were they afraid what it might, were they afraid what it might say?
There's a lot of speculation about that, yeah. But all you have to do is understand the scholarly mindset. If I was given the most important, valuable parchments in all the world, I probably wouldn't rush right out to release them, at least until I had written my own multiple volumes of commentary on them. Everybody has to buy, and then I'm the ultimate scholar before anyone even starts their own research. That's academia. And that really is what happened in the final analysis. But what we've got in the end is a window that is open on the most formative days of Western civilization, literally, that gave birth to what we call Judaism today, what we call Christianity today, and even Islam. These are the three dominant cultures of the modern world, and they're rooted in this time period that we can now look through the looking glass and discover exactly what is going on, what is the mindset behind all these different dreams that are conflicting with each other.
Fascinating. We'll get back to Dr. Hansen now. Dr. Hansen, this is such a big subject, and you tell it very well. We'll have to have you on again. Let's get into Yeshua, Jesus, the New Testament. Besides the New Testament text, what archaeological proof do we have of his life?
Well, I had come in at this from the standpoint of a Judaica scholar in the Judaic Studies program, but I can tell you that Jewish scholars are increasingly interested in the historical Jesus, because after all, he was a Jew. Sometimes people forget that, oddly enough. And he taught like a Jew. He spoke like a Jew. And we learn a whole lot about ancient Judaism and the Dead Sea Scrolls by studying Jesus and his words. Now, did Jesus even exist? I mean, we have to deal with questions like that. There are people who claim that he did not. And there are scholars who claim that he was just a figment of people's imagination. I take the side and the position that he was a historical character, a serious ancient Jewish sage who is testified about not just in the New Testament, not just in the Christian Gospels, but also in the ancient Jewish historian Josephus Flavius, or Flavius Josephus. Here's an ancient text that we have. It came down to us in Greek, but there are hints that there were earlier versions as well. And he tells us point blank that there was a historical character named Jesus. We also have testimony about Jesus from the likes of Tacitus, maybe you heard of Tacitus, or Pliny, another ancient source, that say he existed. But not only that, when you look at text and then you compare the text with what we know about archaeology, then it starts getting really, really interesting, as well as Indiana Jones-esque. I believe that we can pinpoint more or less exactly where Jesus was tried before Pontius Pilate in the city of Jerusalem. I lived in Jerusalem, that's how I know Hebrew, and I've been by there many, many times, and yet it's a fairly new site. It's on the wall of the old city of Jerusalem, and people go by there, they walk by there, drive in the vicinity all the time, they have no idea what they're looking at. But we've got a dead ringer site for where Jesus would have stood before the Roman prefect, Pontius Pilate, and then condemned to crucifixion. It just gives you goosebumps when you're there.
So what you're saying is, explain that a little more. I mean, that's a big statement you just made, and I don't want it to wash over. Just a little bit more.
Exactly. Well, there's a traditional site of the trial of Jesus before Pilate. It's in an ancient Roman structure called the Antonia Fortress, and all the Christian pilgrims go there and have sincere experiences. It's bogus. There's no history behind it. It was all built in the days of, well, at least the pavement they show you was built in the days of the Roman Emperor Hadrian, a good century plus after Jesus came and was crucified. But there's another location that was all covered over by a grassy knoll, let's call it, for centuries and centuries.
Wow.
When I first went to Jerusalem as a young student, it was covered over. Nobody knew what was under there. But the archaeology keeps digging. The diggers keep digging, and they got their Indiana Jones hats, And what they've done is what the Israelis have done is to lower the level of that grassy knoll down a good 50 feet all the way down to bedrock. And they had no idea that they would find an ancient gate there. This is the gate to King Herod's palace, which was massive. And there are serious remains of King Herod's palace. You want to come to Jerusalem, I'll show you. It's incredible. And nobody knew the gate was there. But when we look at the way that gate was laid out, there's no question. There's a rocky outcropping where Pilate would have sat. There's a stairway that comes up where all the crowd would have been gathered. If you read the account of the gospel, exactly, it matches. The Roman soldiers would have been there for crowd control. Jesus would have been brought right out of that gate from the side of Herod's palace. And Pilate himself, he had no interest in staying in a musty, smelly military garrison, which is what the traditional site actually was. He would have been in Herod's palace. That's where he would have been staying. The whole thing matches up. It means we also have to redraw the path of the cross. Maybe you've heard of the Via Dolorosa, where all the Christian pilgrims go.
Yes.
But I'm afraid that's also bogus. Wrong street, wrong century. But if we know where he was tried, and then we've got the tomb itself, which is mind-blowing. Just within the last couple of years, there's been serious excavations in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is a dark, dank, musty place. You go into it and you think, oh, Jesus was entombed here, he was buried here. I don't want this to be the place. And there's a great structure inside that church, underneath this massive grayish dome. And the pilgrims have been filing into that little cramped space for centuries, convinced that Jesus was buried here. Nobody knew for sure. Well, guess what? The whole thing was opened up. One area of it was literally opened up so that we can look down inside and see that, in fact, this is the remains of a first century tomb, exactly where it's supposed to be. Joseph of Arimathea gave it over so that Jesus could be buried there. And the uncanny thing is that the spade uncovers, the more little details seem to be verified that people would have just dismissed before. Whether you're Jewish, whether you're Christian, as I say, Jewish scholars are just as fascinated by the archaeology of this. And a lot of serious Israeli scholars who live in Israel find themselves doing Jesus research.
Well, we got about a minute or so left. I mean, this is fascinating. Again, we'll have to have you on back for a much longer interview. But we have about a minute, or about 30 seconds now. In conclusion, treasuresintime.org, ladies and gentlemen, is the website. Dead Sea Scrolls is, of course, the first book they talk about. It's written several others you can get on this website. Dr. Hansen, it's been a pleasure to get to know you.
Find the YouTube channel.
You have about 10 seconds.
Subscribe. Subscribe to YouTube. I have over 1,100 subscribers and growing, putting out new video all the time.
Well, very good. Well, everybody, it's so good to be with you, and we'll see you next week. Have a fantastic weekend. It's just every day. Look, your power, who you are, getting stronger in your place in this world is of more and more importance every single day. Conviction is king right now. Just pick something. You know, Nike's stealing our taglines. Believe in something. Just pick anything. Go forward. Do it. Do it. Do it. God bless you.